Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your Monday afternoon news and views podcast from the magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangue Ward, and special guest star Emma Camp. Happy last podcast of February, everyone.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Hi there.
Well done. So nearly a month ago, the Cochrane Library, described as the international gold standard for analyzing randomized clinical trials, or RCTs, which themselves are understood to be the gold standard for medical testing, came out with a meta-analysis of 18 RCTs, are you still with me, studying the effectiveness of masks in reducing the spread of COVID-19 and influenza. Conclusion, in the words of the lead author, Oxford's Tom Jefferson, there is just no evidence that they make any difference, full stop. Full stop is British for GFY. Okay, so go look that up, everyone. Rather amazingly, if not quite surprisingly, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reacted by saying it will not change its recommendations that kids as young as 2 wear masks in congregate settings where infection rates are on the rise, said CDC Director Rochelle Walensky at a congressional hearing earlier this month. Quote, our masking guidance doesn't really change with time. This is an important study, but the Cochrane Review only includes randomized clinical trials. And as you can imagine, many of the randomized clinical trials were for other respiratory viruses, and infuriating. Quote, Catherine, your old boss, John Tierney, and recent super friend, John Tierney, had a good piece just today in the Free Press with a second paragraph that reads in entirety, this verdict ought to be the death knell for mask mandates, but that would require the CDC and the rest of the public health establishment to forsake the science. And unfortunately, these leaders and their acolytes in the media seem as determined as ever to ignore actual science. In an ideal Mangue world, Catherine, what would the public health apparatus do now in the wake of these findings?
I think they would take advantage of Emily Oster's proposed COVID amnesty, in which we all forgive each other for having been both very, very angry and very, very wrong in a variety of ways, and we just move on. I don't think that there actually is a really clear way forward in terms of like getting to a tidy resolution here, right? Because the CDC is simply never going to say, we got this completely wrong, we're very sorry. And frankly, even if they did, and I say this with the greatest love in my heart possible for John Tierney, who is the best, he's still not going to be satisfied with it. The people who are angry, sort of personally, viscerally angry about how badly the mask guidance and other guidance went, it's never going to be enough. There will never be enough apologies. And so I think that that becomes kind of beside the point, and that all we can do is do better next time for the most part.
Yeah, but hold on. But hang on, man.
We just got to keep on keeping on.
No, but
we do.
If John Tierney
life
is never going to come down,
heading for another
despite joke. The use of all the pharmaceuticals available, even though he won't come down from his anger bear place, isn't it actually healthy for institutions to self-examine and to make course corrections, even if it doesn't mollify their best critics? Isn't that a way to do it better next time?
Yeah, it absolutely is. But it's also just not a realistic expectation, and it's not a priority. Like, they should just do it better next time. Because I am sympathetic in the way that I am sympathetic to this Emily Oster proposal. Like, they tried. They did it wrong, but they didn't do it wrong because they were messing with us.
Sure about that?
They did it wrong the very, very first time because they were messing with us. When they said, don't use masks, because they were trying to noble lie us into saving masks for the first responders, that they should be sorry for. But then they really thought this was the right thing to do. I don't know. I remain a squish.
I mean, isn't Rochelle Walensky noble lying us even to this day? Right? Like, why are we saying in any setting, in any public policy after this, why is there a mask mandate or even like
a mask
recommendation?
Yeah, and they should drop that mask mandate.
And
but I think there's a difference between get it right going forward and like somehow be sufficiently abased in your mistakes in the past.
Nick,
I don't know that they will get it right going forward if they don't actually kind of own the mistakes that they've made. you know, having been raised Catholic, I am familiar with the act of contrition. And, you know, this is a big deal. I mean, like, the CDC and the entire public health establishment should be using the COVID experience as a time and a place to say, this is what happens when we, you know, get high on our own supply. They need to put into place, and I think do it publicly, and this is not merely for spectacle, you know, this is for getting it right the next time. They need to really do an open inquiry and understanding of why they got it so wrong for so long. And I do think part of that does begin with acknowledging that they were wrong, you know, and it's, you know, I don't have the anger towards maskers or anything like that, that I, you know, I think John Tierney certainly does and a lot of people do, but I don't want to be beholden to public health agencies that are demonstrably wrong and have, and refuse to explain how they are going to do things differently the next time.
But I don't want to be beholden to public health agencies. The problem isn't their particular wrongness in this particular case. It's that they exist and have these rights. They were wrong about vaping. They're wrong about the other wrong, and they're not going to apologize for that either.
I disagree with that. You know, public health agencies, by definition, are not always wrong, or they're not in the wrong, and they don't always do bad things. I think they can be better or worse. They were worse during COVID than they were during polio. What changed? What's the difference? I think that's really important. And I think it also goes towards establishing trust with the public. I don't even think we're talking about rebuilding trust, because they've really, you know, they've squandered whatever trust there was. But I think the CDC could do better. The FDA could do better. And part of it, you know, this is something of a broken record for me, but if the government would be more forthcoming with the limits of its knowledge and the limits of its understanding of things openly, and talk about and engage with people in the same way that businesses have to now, which is, you know, not quite on bended knee, but like government doesn't have a reservoir of trust or confidence that it can, you know, it can rely on. They need to be more open, more transparent, and more engaging with the public.
Emma, Nick was talking about anger, John Tierney's anger, which is never ending, let's be honest. But you're a recent college student. You've been wearing a mask for like 15% of your life, or probably more, I don't even know. But do you have anger from this? And can you testify just a bit, like, what are the practical realities? What was it like to be in that situation when you were being masked? I remember when I was in the recent DC office most recently, I was sitting around all you children for a while, and I brought up the subject of masking in college, and everyone's eyes went nuts. Can you talk about how?
What does that mean? Did they start spinning, or
just nuts? Just
little flames shooting out of them.
Can you talk about how you feel about all this, you know, now that the Cochrane study has come out and basically said, yeah, it wasn't all worth it?
Yeah, I certainly have some anger, but I think I'm sympathetic to Catherine's position, which is that while it would be nice to have an apology, you're just not going to get one. And I was going to bring up the Emily Oster article, because I think that when we have all of these problems post-COVID restrictions, especially relating to college students and school-age people, right, where you have kids that are more depressed than ever and they can't read, and we have all of these, you know, 20 years of improvement in test scores that we've lost, I really think we're better off using our political will to improve those outcomes and to attack the problems that we have right now rather than trying to exact vengeance, even though it would be really awesome to get some vengeance. But when I think about the period of my life in which I was under like really strict COVID restrictions, which was really my junior year of college and then sort of partially in my senior year of college, it's honestly kind of surreal. I remember at the time I was reflecting on this, I was actually quite, not so much my senior year, really not at all. Basically, post getting a vaccine, COVID was over for me. But before that, I was really into it almost. Like, I was the person that was like, hey, everybody, can we wear a mask? I was like, why was I like a weird little mask Nazi? And when I was thinking about it, the reason why wasn't that I was actually afraid of getting COVID. It was that I was afraid of what would happen to me and what the university would do to me if I got COVID. Oh. Because I had a bunch of roommates. The pod of people I was in had a bunch of roommates. So if I tested for COVID, me and about 15 other people would have to test for COVID. And we'd have to be completely isolated for 2 weeks, maybe whisked asked off to quarantine dorms. And, you know, there was a huge social cost to getting COVID, right? If you got COVID, you were a plague rat, right? And then it's also all of the social cost. And what I was afraid of and what made me sort of shiver in the cold at 2 a.m., quote unquote, 6 feet apart from my friends instead of just having a party like a normal person, is I was afraid of what my college would do to me, not afraid of what COVID would do to me. And it really was the level of insanity at certain points is, I don't know, it's infuriating, but also almost amusing to look back on. I mean, for one, we had basically a mask mandate until the end of my senior year. And so, you know, you could go to frat parties with 200 people and that was fine, but you had to wear a mask to sit, you know, 6 feet away from someone else in class. But my college's chapter of the YDSA did some particularly interesting COVID
protests.
What is
YDSA?
The Young Democratic Socialists of America. They were the source of a lot of fury over UVA not doing enough when they were doing quite a lot. I think my favorite was there were a couple in-person classes at the beginning of the fall 2020 semester. And these classes were like 15 people and sharing an entire auditorium, like they were very distanced. And to protest this, the YDSA staged a die-in, which was, you guessed it, in person, and involved college students laying down in front of the rotunda at UVA, very, very uniformly 6 feet apart, to show how many UVA students were going to die because of in-person classes. Anyone know how many UVA students died of COVID? None. There was a tracker. I also believe none were hospitalized. It's almost like COVID is not really a huge risk to healthy 18 to 22-year-olds.
Yeah, we're still like at 1,000 deaths, right, under 18 from COVID.
It's not much at all. You just gave me PTSD about the die-ins and the protests with coffins held by teachers in the New York City public school system. Nick, go forth.
Y'all are classier than us because we just had the people were just wrapped in trash bags. Like they just went body bags here in D.C. So it's nice that you had real coffins, honestly.
It's collapsible. That's good. But, you know, the choice isn't between, you know, absolute foam-flecked spittle rage vengeance and doing nothing. It's having an open process of like the CDC explaining why they did what they did, understanding, like, you know, and again, this isn't about like punishing people as much as it is like figuring out what were the processes in place that got it so wrong at so many levels for the CDC. And we've done things like this, you know, with, you know, the Rockefeller Commission and the Church Committee in, you know, in the 70s for internal spying. It doesn't work forever, but there are punctuated moments where the government has said, you know what, we really screwed up and we're going to examine our process. We're going to do it in the light of day and we're going to work through those steps. And again, the twofold, you know, outcome, a benefit of that is one is that you hopefully get a better process because things can be better or worse. And then the secondary effect is that you might actually help build public confidence, not in the anger bears of the world, not in the cocaine anger bears of the world, but in the vast majority of people who are willing to go along,
and say
like, okay, government can be better.
Going to put cocaine anger bear as our next. Is it our next cover or do we do the cocaine anger bear as our next centerfold, do you think?
Halloween, our quarterly Halloween party should in.
I think the next issue should include, you know, some cocaine in it as well.
To Nick's point, I just want to add two words. Richard Everlovin Feynman. Okay? That was a good, okay. good.
I thought you were going with Richard Nixon.
Yeah. Catherine, R. Jacob Sullum, an American hero, has been writing about the CDC's and Rochelle Walensky in particular's very shoddy use of mask science over the years. He did this before the Cochrane study, and then when the Cochrane study came out, he reminded people again the gap between their conclusions and what and how the CDC and Walensky have been using these facts, and for which Reason and Jacob were slapped with a potentially misleading label on Facebook. Do you want to talk about Facebook dissing the high quality and super careful work of Jacob Everlovin Sullum?
Yeah, I'm pretty mad about it. because how dare they? How dare they come for my Jacob Sullum, who is, he's so precise. He's so careful. He does not overclaim. Like, there's the very idea that the same people who shoveled around misinformation, disinformation, whatever you want to call it, about so many aspects of COVID and masking and the lab leak theory and 20 other things should then put that a Jacob Sullum column is, quote, missing context, quote, could mislead people, and that independent fact checkers did not enjoy it. How dare they? They are blessed to read every word that Jacob Sullum offers to them. And, you know, the fact that these labels are getting put on pieces that are specifically teaching the controversy, right? Pieces that are explaining the two sides and, you know, coming to a conclusion, certainly, but not without evidence, is just frankly infuriating. This is, of course, part and parcel with our recent troubles with the Global Disinformation Index, which found that Reason was one of the 10 riskiest sites for online news, despite not at any point anywhere in that study finding a single thing that was actually wrong. Not one. That's not the methodology of the study. It was not to look and see if things were wrong, which is where I would start if I was trying to figure that question out. But Jacob has rightly written that, like, the entire concept of disinformation at this point is just so corrupted, right? It is simply a sort of accusation that you fling at people whose conclusions you don't enjoy, or whose motivations you suspect, or both. And, you know, I do think that it will probably lose its power over time, but not before the concept has done quite a lot of harm. And I think these Facebook labels are a good example of that.
Nick, there's we've talked at Reason, written a Reason, including Jacob Sullum, a memorable cover story from like 15 years ago about the totalitarian implications of public health. But we talked about that. Is there a sense of the sort of the paternalism, right? Anti-daddy state, mommy state, paternalism of government and public health agencies. Do you see that ethic creeping over into journalism? Does it seem that there's more like leading you? It's like as if explanatory journalism isn't explaining what a thing is or a fact is. It's explaining how you should think about it and feel about it and maybe act.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've really hit the nail on the head there, Matt, that, you know, there's an encroaching sense of we're not going to actually show both sides of anything and let you come to your own conclusion in more and more areas of life, that public discourse is about instructing people in proper thinking, not as a, you know, not as a process, but as a conclusion. And that's a real loss. I think a lot about this because there was a moment when I was in grad school in the late 80s, early 90s, where there became this palpable switch from where older professors, and God help me that I'm going to say anything good about the baby boom, but the people, the professors who would bore all of the students with, you know, discussions of being tear gassed on the UC campuses in the late 60s, et cetera, they were like, hey, you know what? The point of the university is to have a place that's apart from the rest of society where you can just run with whatever ideas you have and see where they lead, good, bad, or indifferent. And they were being elbowed out by people who were like, no, what we are doing is we are training a kind of cadre of salesmen who are going out and selling a particular product, which was, you know, for them, it was a kind of pathetic pre-end of communism critique of capitalism. But that was like all the difference in the world, like the idea of let's talk about it to we are past the point of talking, you are going out and selling this. And I feel like that has crept into more and more things. And I hadn't really thought about it in the context of explaining, you know, or explainer service journalism for thinking. But that's where we're at, man.
That's a good bridge into our next topic, which, because Peter is not here and not moderating, is not going to have a label. But I appreciate. I know.
I'm against the labels when we have them, but I miss them when they're gone.
That's
contrarianism at its best, I guess.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Last week in a
Can we call this section the missing link?
Nope. Emma Camp. Okay. Wrote about this last week in a telegraphed move. Florida legislators who are loyal to Governor Ron DeSantis meatball Ron DeSantis introduced a bill that would remove many of the legal protections against defamation lawsuits that had been established by the 1964 Supreme Court case New York Times versus Sullivan, which imposed an actual malice standard for aggrieved parties to prove their critics in the press or elsewhere had defamed them. Emma, you wrote about this bill, including its critics within the free speech and biz. Can you walk us through what this would do and why people are leery of it?
Yes, I definitely can do that. As you all can tell, the good people at home can't see it, but I have lots of notes because this bill is calorie dense, I think is how I would describe it. I think any one of its provisions would be worth talking about, but I guess DeSantis and his allies decided to save us the trouble and put about seven provisions that are worth talking about in there at once. So the way I think about what this bill is trying to do, it's kind of can be broken down into two main categories. One category is going after journalists using anonymous sources. And the second is kind of changing the way actual malice can be required to get a victory in a defamation case. So when it comes to the anonymous sources provisions, one of the first things that the bill does is that it creates a carve out in Florida's journalist privilege law, which is a kind of law that a lot of kind of federal circuits and states have, which basically means that under most circumstances, journalists will not be required to reveal, to identify their anonymous sources in legal proceedings. This bill would just create a carve out to that law when it relates to defamation cases. The second thing that this would do in relating to journalists that's probably one of the more noteworthy provisions is that it would just automatically assume for defamation purposes that any statement by an anonymous source is false. The law would just assume that they're false. And then kind of making things worse, if a journalist refuses to identify their anonymous source in order to obtain a victory in a defamation case, all the plaintiff has to do is prove negligence. So basically, actual malice wouldn't be required, which kind of dovetails nicely into the changes to actual malice. So actual malice under this bill will be able to be inferred in a significantly broader number of circumstances than current defamation law allows. So currently, actual malice is basically defined as a statement that's made with knowledge that it was false or with reckless disregard of whether it was false or not. This bill basically does away with that. And so, for example, you can infer actual malice if the statement was fabricated by the defendant, inherently implausible based, again, kind of going back, based on an unverified anonymous report, or under this other category of having obvious reasons to doubt. The notable thing about that is one of the kinds of statements that means that there is an obvious reason to doubt its veracity is if someone makes an accusation that somebody else discriminated on the basis of race, sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. Because Ron DeSantis can never stay too far away from the culture war. Basically, statements that accuse someone of discrimination on the basis of these protected characteristics, both will be kind of in and of themselves reasons to infer actual malice. And that category is defamation per se, which basically means if the accusation is false, it is defamation. And of course, the law also sort of removes some of the ways in which someone might try to prove that their accusation isn't false. When it comes to accusations of discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity, you can't appeal to someone's religious beliefs or their, quote, scientific beliefs. Another provision related to actual malice is that when the accusation at hand, when the allegedly defamatory statement doesn't relate to the reason why the person is a public figure, you don't need to show actual malice. So my understanding of that would be something like if someone is a professional basketball player and the allegedly defamatory statement is that they like cheated on their wife or something, you wouldn't need to prove actual malice. But if it's an accusation that they took performance-enhancing drugs or something, you would. And then there's...
Also with their wife?
Also with their wife.
Preferably.
That's how I like to take performance-enhancing drugs.
Okay.
Emma, we'll leave it there because it's obviously very, very long, but thank you for that thorough debriefing, and you can circle back to other bits if we have time for it. But Catherine, I wanted to get you in here because, Ron D. Sanctimonious isn't the only one who's going after New York Times versus Sullivan. You know, the before we had Butt Gorsuch, we had Butt Thomas among libertarian people looking for any kind of salve to console them with Republican presidencies. But it's Clarence Thomas and a little bit Neil Gorsuch who seem kind of eager to revisit this. What gives? Dang it.
I honestly don't understand. I mean, I get that we are just in a situation now where, because all sides have resorted to kind of power politics to, you know, to like, as Stephanie Slade calls it, kind of will to power conservatism versus a kind of authoritarian progressivism. So that means that we're just looking for cudgels, anything that's kind of laying on the ground that we can hit each other with. We want to weaponize it. And it's, you know, it's just hard for me to understand why people would look at, for instance, the UK, where these rules are already quite different than our own, and where speech is, you know, constantly being restrained and stifled, and say, like, yeah, let's make our system look more like that. Like, that's where we want to go. It doesn't make sense to me, except if you just assume that everyone is taking a kind of nihilistic, we want these weapons in our hands and we're not worried about the fact that soon enough the other side will wield them as well. I think that Emma had it right when she said DeSantis never misses an opportunity to culture war. So most of this is about that. If DeSantis's record on culture war, kind of big pushes, big efforts is any indication, this isn't going to happen. Like, this won't end up really being a thing. Our cover story of the current issue is a great essay by Eric Boehm that makes this point, that DeSantis keeps doing big, splashy, culture war-ish things, but they keep not really fully manifesting. And that is our only saving grace with him at this point. I don't want to rely on that, obviously. You know, if he tries hard enough times, one of these things is going to go through. But you know, it is my profound hope that this will fail as his previous efforts have failed.
Kind of reminds me, when you put it that way, of what I wrote about Hillary Clinton before the 2016 election, looking through her history of coming up with proposals, laws, task forces at all having to do with restricting access to video games or internet to kids to protect the children. And one after another were struck down by the Supreme Court, usually, or by other courts in the system. And that was the protection then. But Nick, I wonder if and both of us have in the past cited the, I think, 2009 book by the NYU law prof Barry Friedman called The Will of the People: How Public Opinion Has Influenced the Supreme Court and Shaped the Meaning of the Constitution, where, to boil it down over much, he basically says Supreme Court kind of ratifies where public consensus has shifted after the fact. Do you worry that he's more right than the, let's say, or like that factor that he's talking about is going to have more sway than what we have also seen in the last 10 years, which is a pretty robust defense of the First Amendment at the Supreme Court level?
Yeah, I mean, the Supreme Court has been great on free speech, really, for like 25 years, 30 years, or you could take it all the way back to Sullivan. You know, one of the things that I think about, kind of going into old man mode again, is to, you know, if you grew up in the 70s and 80s, you took free speech as an absolute right, or as close to an absolute right as it could be, you know, as just the universal truth. Nobody was arguing anymore. It was a self-evident truth. And increasingly, you know, it's becoming clear that that period from, you know, about 1955 until maybe 2005 or something, there was a good 50 years where that was true. And it's just, it wasn't true before that. And increasingly, it seems to be less and less taken. It's certainly not taken for granted. And I do think that the Supreme Court, you know, follows where the American population is, or Republican consensus is, which is deeply troubling. This push to open up the libel laws really does come from the right. And it needs, you know, this was a big thing that Donald Trump started talking about, wanting to open up the libel laws. Meatball Ron, I really think Cocaine Ron sounds really good, and he is from Florida. And cocaine is pretty good as a, you know, modifier for any political figure. But, you know, DeSantis, this is also should be seen as an attempt to steal some of Trump's thunder while also shutting the door on, you know, the orange Mussolini or whatever people ended up calling him. But it's deeply disturbing. And, you know, conservatives and, conservatives have no moral compass at this point as a political bloc. They feel like they are so under attack, they are willing to do whatever they can to kind of stay in the conversation or take it over. And it's not going to be good. It's really, really deeply, deeply disturbing. And unfortunately, you know, people on the left, I don't think they're going after libel laws as much, but they are, you know, they are waiting at the table to say, yeah, let's regulate speech more. We've been pushing this in a different way for decades. So glad to have you here. It's really not good. And I worry about the Supreme Court on all of this.
Emma, Reason and libertarians in general have been among the first to point out the kind of injustices that have happened in the name of abused due process, whether in actual writing of due process in the law or kind of the cultural sense of due process. I'm thinking here about under Obama, the changing of the Title IX rules to go after campus sexual assault, which really lowered the bar for being able to kind of kick a kid out without having him able to defend himself. And I think about Joe Biden is bringing those things back. Thinking also about the excesses of Me Too, people who were kind of drummed out of polite society, even though there really wasn't a lot of evidentiary standard. And some of the stuff that came after George Floyd in the summer of 2020, kind of a racial reckoning type of overreaction. So we tend to say, hey, look, you're going too far on this. People are innocent until proven guilty. I wonder if in defense of the conservatives that Nick Gillespie just slimed, is there something that libertarians should think about in terms of a remedy for people who find themselves on the butt end of this? I mean, DeSantis had a media panel a couple of weeks ago that was, where he's sitting at a desk with the word truth behind him. It was kind of strange. One of the people he had there was the Covington kid, right? The kid who was defamed. And that's a teaser for something that I'm going to bring up a little bit later. Not defamed, I'm sorry, wrong word, but he was slimed by the media everywhere as being a racist because of the way he smirked on Capitol Hill in 2019. Should we be thinking more proactively about, hey, look, there should be a higher penalty associated or a cost incurred by super casual, reckless allegations that are not just like on social media, but they're by journalistic institutions?
I think in the social sphere, yes, but I am extremely cautious about getting the law involved. And I'll be the first to say there are definitely downsides to the current defamation law we have. You know, I'm sure all of us have had people say nasty and untrue things about us. I certainly have had a lot of experience of people, a lot of them at once, saying a lot of nasty and untrue things about me. And it's not fun. There are downsides, but there are also
Matt has apologized for that.
I did, yeah.
He won't do it again.
But, you know, there are also, in my opinion, way more upsides to having the law that we currently have. Like, yes, it can really damage people's lives, like the Covington kid is a good example when they have these things said about them. But it can also damage people's lives to be in a world where you say something that maybe is untrue, maybe isn't, maybe it's just mean, maybe it's a mistake, and then all of a sudden you have a massive legal battle on your hands. Something that I forgot to mention earlier that I think is really important is that when it comes to that accusation that someone discriminated on the basis of these protected characteristics, if you are found to have committed defamation, along with all the other damages the court is supposed to give you, you also have another $35,000 fine, which is absurd, right? And so I think we can both say, like, yes, when journalistic institutions publish things that are false or like nasty in a particularly likely to be false way, even if they're technically opinion, there should be a strong social cost to that. People should feel comfortable saying that this is wrong. And, you know, you should retract the article, you should apologize. But I think when we get the law involved, we run a really high chance of silencing more speech than the costs just outweigh the benefits, in my opinion.
Just, I wanted to sort of note an example of this mentality already permeating the conversation, which is the New York Times, the letter about coverage of transgender issues that was signed by 890 contributors last week, 2 weeks ago, whenever it was. There's a sentence in that letter, and they say, "The natural destination of poor editorial judgment is the court of law." That's the scariest shit I've ever heard. And not just because I'm the one out here exercising poor editorial judgment every day by publishing this podcast, but also like that whole framework is wrong. The natural destination of poor editorial judgment is getting outcompeted in the media space by another publication. The natural destination of poor editorial judgment is having to publish an op-ed on the other side or a bunch of letters to the editor. It is absolutely not a court of law. We have all these other mechanisms to deal with dumb opinions and even lies. But we should not use the courts for that. That's the wrong way to go about it. And the fact that these, you know, hundreds of journalists were threatening a publication in which they have appeared.
They were thinkers. They called themselves thinkers. By the way, as thinkers.
They were all their yeah. words had appeared in the Times, right? Like, yeah. or their work had appeared in the Times. And the fact that they were none too subtly threatening legal action for just like having the wrong angle on trans stuff sometimes shows that, you know, the thing that you were raising earlier about, you know, the concern that the court will simply follow. And I think by public opinion, we also typically mean elite opinion there, which are two different things. Yeah, that bodes ill indeed.
Catherine, to close this section, I wanted to make sure to give you at least a few seconds to reflect on your high witch priestess, J.K. Rowling, out there threatening litigation right and left. Against her critics, who are quite frequently, if not even typically, deranged in calling her a transphobe and whatever else. And those critics, because they're in the United Kingdom, which is a second world country, are like being brought to heel. Is that a good thing?
Nope. That's exactly what I was saying. Like, the UK is not our model here. We do not want our country to look like that. And I think, you know, not only is it a bad thing in terms of the specifics of these cases, I think it's a bad thing for her position, right? Like, if you want to stick up for her, if you know, which I sometimes do. I mean, I don't exactly share her take on trans issues, but I don't think it's insane. I don't think it's literally causing trans people to die for her to have the opinions that she has. And she's making it hard for me to defend her. I sure wish she wouldn't do that. I wish she would just calmly state her view in the public sphere, which is what she's historically done pretty well. You know, I personally wouldn't have, again, done it the way that she did it, by just kind of occasionally popping up and doing a tweet that absolutely incenses a really, really, really highly invested and angry group of people. It's not how I like to do argumentation, but that's fine. If that's her approach, what is not fine is suing people to shut them up.
All right. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, do you really know yourself? Are you the same person that you were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 54 and a half years ago? And if not, are you adjusting your self-conception and way of operating in the world accordingly? Therapy with a trained independent arbiter can be a worthwhile way of deepening your self-awareness, tinkering with your interior operating system, and coping better with the world. Did I say better? Yes, I did. Here's where BetterHelp online therapy comes in. BetterHelp is easy to use, super flexible, entirely online. Just fill out a quick questionnaire and start increasing your self-knowledge right away. You can discover your potential with BetterHelp. Just visit BetterHelp.com/roundtable today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/roundtable. Go there today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder, email us your readably short queries to roundtable at reason.com. This one comes from our unfailingly polite international correspondent, Nicholas Durpich, and it goes a little something like this. Beloved Reason editors, this is like the song, a letter from St. Paul. I'd like to ask you a kind of a meta question, something about Reason magazine itself. If you had to choose only about three printed numbers, asterisk, Matt is putting in there, of the magazine to have and to read for the rest of your lives, which editions would you choose and why? Which number or maybe article, I love the word number there, do you think better represents the essence of free minds and free markets? In the same sense, which particular article would you suggest for an average person to read and to convince him or her to subscribe? Sorry, love and peace. I'm going to edit this, moderator's privilege. Everyone gets to name one issue of the magazine and one particular article to satisfy these particular requirements. Catherine, you start.
I would love to start. I'm going to name the October 2018 issue. This was our first debate issue. And I loved it because I, as per our entire previous first half of this podcast, think that people should be able to talk about stuff. Controversial stuff, stuff that they disagree about, they should be able to do it in a way that is productive. And I think that the way that people are productive is when you give them overly formal guidelines and boundaries in which to do things. This is who I am as a person, but it's also how debate works. And I think it's good. That issue was fun and spicy. We talked about Nick and I debated anarchism, and I won. And we also debated
taxation is theft are still the three saddest words in the English language.
We talked about abortion. We talked about data privacy, gay wedding cakes, vegetarianism, and more. We're doing it again. We're doing another debate issue. The next issue will be a debate issue, and you know, the idea of both of these issues is not just let's fight about everything like with the socialists. It's let's fight about stuff libertarians disagree about. And I think that that is a really good place to start. You know, share some common values, share something, you know, some basic terms of agreement. But then there's still a lot to fight about. I think it's Reason at its best when we can make space for those type of conversations. So get ready for debate issue two, Electric Boogaloo.
Article.
I am going to pick the cover story of what I think is actually the best issue of Reason ever, which is the one published in June 2004 under Nick's editorship, the We Know Where You Live issue, which had little GPS pictures of everybody's house on the cover, which in 2004 was a real mind-blowing moment. The often underappreciated cover story of that issue by Declan McCullough was about how it's fine that privacy is over. And when I read that piece, it really changed my mind, which is always a sign of a good article. When you went in thinking one thing, you came out the far side thinking the other thing. The piece was about the upsides of zero privacy. And I have looked at many of the debates, including the current debate about AI and surveillance associated with AIs through that lens. I think it's prevented me from giving way to the doom and gloom that so many of my fellow libertarians have fallen to.
Nick, you were an editor of this fine magazine. What are your picks for best or, you know, most noteworthy, for whatever reason, issue of the mag and best article?
So the writer had asked which was, you know, a good issue and story that would get people to subscribe. And I'm picking the 2019 August-September issue as my favorite issue. And that was one where the glass was half full and half empty, depending if you were on the front or the back of the cover. And kind of similar to the debate issue, this one also under Catherine's guidance, but there were so many stories, even the negative stories were kind of positive. And I think it's an incredible sampler. It's like, you know, the Whitman sampler of Reason magazine takes on why things are getting better. And while why there are still problems, but we're going to overcome them, it's a really, you know, it just exudes the kind of studied optimism, I would say, that libertarians at their best kind of, you know, show the world. And I think Reason has consistently from its very early days. So I really like the 2019 August-September issue because it shows how far we've come. You know, since 1968, say, when the magazine started, and how much further we're going to be going. For my particular story, I am a huge fan of Chuck Freund's, Charles Paul Freund's story from the March 2002 issue, which is called In Praise of Vulgarity. And it was in the wake of 9/11 and the invasion of Afghanistan. It talked about what happened in Afghanistan in particular when the Taliban was deposed. And the men went out and got their beard shaved and their hair cut in an outlawed, the Taliban, among many crazy things, had outlawed beetle haircuts and what was called the Titanic, which was the coif that Leonardo DiCaprio had in Titanic. And it was very popular in Afghanistan. And the Taliban, you know, banned that for men. They banned nail salons and all kinds of cosmetics for women. So the men went out, shaved their beards, got their hair cut, and women went to nail salons. And out of that, Chuck built this incredible story of why people are subversive of state and corporate power in a way that is just amazingly learned, wide-ranging, and fascinating. And that story in and of itself, I think, exemplifies what Reason does best, which is bring a radically distinct viewpoint, one that is optimistic, but is also realistic and is very, is very clear in the limits of the worldview, but also the power of it. And he took on a bunch of critics from within the United States who were saying things like, you know, it was pathetic that Afghans, given freedom, went and did things they enjoyed rather than things that they should, you know, like they need to eat their cultural vegetables and go to serious movies or symphonies or this or that. In Praise of Vulgarity is just, it's a timeless story, despite the fact, or maybe because it is in absolute conversation with one of the hinge points of the past half century.
I will second that nomination. Emma Camp. These all happened before you were born, of course, but what's your go-to issue and article in response to this question?
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and because I have only been working at Reason for about 8 or 9 months or so, I feel like I don't quite have the fount of knowledge on print issues. So I think choosing the one since I've been here that I enjoyed reading the most, I think my favorite issue and my favorite article are in the same issue, which is the October 2022 Authoritarian Convergence issue. I think that cover story by Stephanie Slade presents such a compelling argument for why kind of a liberty-minded view on politics is so important, because it profiles the descent into authoritarianism, both in terms of trying to quash civil liberties, but also regulate the market on both the left and right, even if they're doing it in slightly different ways, and sort of the importance of preserving the sane third option there. And of course, in speaking of third options in that issue, there was also sort of a history of the Libertarian Party, probably the most famous third option in American politics. And I just found it to be a really solid issue. It had also my first piece in Reason Magazine itself, just a little topic, but you know, it has a warm place in my heart because of that.
The ones I'll take, July 2011, this is under my editorship, but I claim no credit for it, aside from giving two then editors, Jacob Sullum, the aforementioned American hero, and Radley Balco in one of his last acts for Reason before he moved on then to the Huffington Post. I told them, give us a criminal justice special issue, and I will just sit back and take all the credit for it. It was the longest issue by far during my editorship, and it probably is competitive with one of the longest we've ever done. And it was just a wonderful, thoroughgoing compilation of the very kind of robust and internally, you know, quarreling group of people who want to figure out ways to fix the criminal justice system in the United States. You have Radley Balco in there, Ken White of Pope Hat fame, Peter Moskos, Michelle Alexander, Mark Kleiman, Harvey Silverglate, Tim Lynch, even the margins, then the marginalia in the issue are terrific. It's more about the sum of its parts than any particular edition. And I have fondness for it, particularly because, as I said, it was one of Radley Palico's last efforts for the magazine. Radley did a wonderful job in prioritizing criminal justice issue for reason, and also like kind of creating or helping to create a new category of young libertarians. People got into libertarianism because of what they saw as the way the criminal justice system was mistreating people and causing injustice. And at the time of him leaving, there was some worry in some quarters that, oh, you know, somehow that's going to be the end of reason talking about criminal justice issues in this way. Not only does the issue kind of refute that, but so does all of our track record ever since, including a special October 2020 issue called Fix the Police, where we build on that that came in. So very terrific. And I just appreciate, you know, stuff that happens on my watch that I don't touch. It's the goal of all management, as Nick knows. Individual article that strikes me as particularly noteworthy about a style of thing that Reason does and differentiates itself in the modern media landscape, as kind of teased before. This came in January 20th of 2019 by Robbie Suave. Title on it is "The Media Wildly Mischaracterized That Video of Covington Catholic Students Confronting a Native American Veteran." What is amazing about this piece is that Robbie did nothing that any other journalist couldn't do. This is, I think, like a day and a half or so after the initial outrage, which became wall-to-wall news for reasons that just seem absurd thinking back on it. A smirk on a kid's face meant racism or something. But Robbie went and watched all the source video, because there was a lot of video floating around that people posted on YouTube and various places, and discovered that the media narratives, not just like, you know, people talking on Twitter, but like stuff in the Washington Post and elsewhere, were just wildly wrong and easily disprovably wrong. And so using actual patience and looking through available evidence to discover that media narratives become self-reinforcing loops of wrong information is one of the specialties that I think Reason does. Many such examples over the years, going back to our classic Love Canal cover story and others. But that's a thing that we do. And it's a way to pull in people who aren't familiar with Reason and don't necessarily care or know about where we lean philosophically or editorially. I think people appreciate honest brokers out there in the news. And that's the memo. All right, we're getting late here in this robust episode. So let's go to what we have all been consuming in the cultural arena. Catherine, why don't you go first?
I had some beer.
Yeah.
And since Suderman's not here, I will pick up the slack on booze-based consumption, I guess. I purchased this beer obviously exclusively for the name, which is it's a third party triple. So it's by Denizens Brewing Company. It's got a cute little, I don't know, it's like a fox or something in a party hat with a blazer on the label. And it is a Belgian style 9.4%, my friends. And so that's what I want to say is basically that is the only appropriate strength for a third party celebrating beer. You're really going to need to drink to get through it if that's how you affiliate. It is characterized by, I am told in the tasting notes, the fact that Belgians use additional candied sugar as part of their fermentable sugars, which makes things fruity and spicy and very, very boozy. If there's one thing I can say about third parties, it's they're fruity, spicy, and very, very boozy. And this was a good beer. So my recommendation to you in Suderman's absence.
Nick, what have you been consuming?
I finally got around to reading The Philosophy of Modern Song by Bob Dylan, which came out late last year. And it is... and I also want to point out the Spotify playlist because it's a series of songs. It's, you know, 60 songs or something like that, 66 songs that Dylan kind of does notes on. And then there's a guy by the name of TJ McDonald who put the playlist together on Spotify, which is also just you know, an incredible revelation to listen to the songs. But Dylan goes through the American songbook of about like the past hundred years or so, and it's just very wide ranging. His section on Little Richard and Tutti Frutti is great, and I just want to read a little bit from it. Little Richard is the master of the double entendre. Tutti Frutti is a good example. A fruit, a male homosexual, and Tutti Frutti is all fruit. It's also a sugary ice cream. A gal named Sue and a gal named Daisy, and they're both transvestites. Of all the people who sang Tutti Frutti, Dylan writes, Pat Boone was probably the only one who knew what he was singing about. And Pat knows about speaking in tongues as well. It is just, in the particulars, it's cryptic in the best way that Dylan is. But more important, Dylan has been kind of locking down a broad understanding of American culture for the past century, at least, in a world where people keep talking about how, including Dylan, how international capital has kind of destroyed all traditions and customs and the primacy of local, of small things in kind of places that are shut off from the rest of the world. Dylan is piecing together a way to live in this world and to kind of keep your bearings and to keep open to the vast possibilities that have been opened up by this destruction of the local and of the small. And The Philosophy of Modern Song is just an incredible read. It's wonderful. You can dip in and out of it. It's like a pint of ice cream that never disappears. But, every night you can have a couple of spoonfuls. Fantastic. And then I highly, highly recommend the Spotify playlist, the version of Trucking. And Dylan's tastes are extremely eclectic in this. At one point, he's talking about Bill Monroe and Roddy James Dio in the same sentence, the guy who invented, is the modern father of bluegrass, and Roddy James Dio, who is one of the great kind of satanic rock masters. But the playlist, there's a version of Trucking from the Grateful Dead's 1972 album, the one where the kid is hitting himself on the head with the ice cream cone. That is fantastic. And if you're reading it to Dylan's kind of summary of Trucking, it's transcendent. So, The Philosophy of Modern Song.
I would supplement that with, go check out an interview. I think it was done in the Wall Street Journal, but there's a longer version on Bob Dylan's own site. Bob Dylan Notes, I think it is, Nick. Maybe you know better than I. That came out when the book came out. And it's like many Bob Dylan interviews, and as Jack Schaefer has said before many times, Bob Dylan is still undefeated in all interviews. But it's marvelous. It's to Nick's point about a way of being in the world, a way of consuming music, a way of being open to things in the world. It's just a beautiful thing to behold. So go.
And to remember things in an age where stuff disappears before we, every news cycle, we have forgotten what we're outraged about. We only remember the feeling of being angry. Dylan gives us a place to hang our coat.
I'm still mad at the balloon. When are we going to kill another balloon? Emma Camp, what have you consumed in the cultural arena?
Over the past week or so, I have sort of sped through the podcast from American Public Media called Sold a Story, which is about how it came to be that about 2 in 3 American fourth graders can't really read. And the various forces at play, the various kind of scientifically debunked curriculum that are in many cases still in use, that led to a circumstance where we are not teaching children to read using phonics, which, based on the science we have, is basically the only way that people learn how to read. And it really gripped me as someone who writes a lot about education and kind of education data for reason. It really kind of exercised me and sort of haunted me after I had listened to it. Because of how angry it made me and because of how many young lives were likely kind of permanently destroyed because of ineffective teaching.
Very good. I will add for my entrant here, I've always been a fan of weird little museums. I'm a fan of bizarre.
You're a weird little museum. I don't know what that means.
You should see, actually, holy cow, you have just described my office. This is a very weird little museum. Should I show you the Matt doll for the
Matt Welsh?
I would love to see the Matt doll.
This is...
We can't... We're, it's an audio is, podcast, you yeah. dumb butts. Yeah. Like, what are we...
You're looking at a Matt doll. There we are. Anyways, that's what we're talking about.
You sure that's not a repurposed Ben Affleck doll?
It's not. He never had long orange hair. Look. Yet. I went to a house museum in Los Angeles in the Silver Lake neighborhood. It used to be called Edendale for trivia buffs back home, called the Holy Land Exhibition. And holy cow, is it just so weird. I'm really glad in retrospect that last time our wonderful art director, Joanna Andreessen, went to LA. She's like, what should I do in LA, Matt? You used to live there. And knowing how weird Joanna is, she's got like stuffed squirrels in her wall in her apartment here. Like, go to the Holy Land exhibition, even though I myself hadn't been there. Now I have, took my daughter. It's amazing. So it is a this guy named Antonia Futterer. Just are already weird that a guy has an Antonia name. He, 100 years ago, traveled extensively to the Middle East, to the Holy Land in the 1920s, because he was in search of the Ark of the Covenant. Yes, this is the person who's likely the semi-model for the Indiana Jones character, although he was not a prominent archaeologist of any type. He was a, as they say, eclectic religious adventurer. So he went out there to try to like get stuff from Syria, Damascus, and Egypt, and Israel. And he looked for a long time for the Ark. And he would bring back things to his Silver Lake house, little trinkets, tourist things, and big, wonderful kind of discoveries. And Lord knows how he acquired all of them. They're a little bit light on those details. This is a by appointment only museum. There's a family that runs the place. I don't know what relation that family has with the Futterer estate. Maybe they are the Futterer estate. Nothing is made clear. You just walk in and this great, extravagant kind of elderly magisterial hippie gal comes out, fumbles with a gigantic set of keys, trying to figure out how to get to the Damascus room, and then walks you up a set of stairs, and you're in this room and see this incredible inlaid 200-year-old gaming table that has all these different nooks and crannies. It's just crazy. It is set up as an interfaith understanding place. So there's the Jew stuff, the Muslim stuff, and the Christian stuff. There is a piece of the Temple Mount, a tile, because there's an earthquake there when he was around. And apparently he just like, and like picked up a tile.
Sure, pal. Put it, a likely earthquake.
Put it in his shirt or something. I don't know. They dress you up in a costume at some point for reasons that are unexplained. And then she has this whole, like, you can't really like take her off her prepared script. They give you a piece of, they give you some like Turkish delight and some grape juice. There's a big board where it explains the history of the family tree of man through the names of the Bible and the pointing to stuff. None of it makes sense. It's fantastic. Go check it out. The Holy Land exhibition. And the guy, of course, was friends, and this will delight Nick, with Amy Semple McPherson, a great American and Los Angelino back in the day, whose Angelus Temple was just down the street. So enjoy it while it still lasts. I can't imagine. Be interested to see like how much all that stuff is collectively worth, or what actual museums think about it. But it's a really great and wonderful way to spend 90 minutes to 2 hours. Okay. Speaking of spending 90 minutes with people, that's about how long this thing is almost gone. So thank you for listening to the Reason Roundtable. Check out all of our podcasts, reason.com/podcasts. Nick Gillespie, what do we have in the future in terms of speaking easy in the city of New York?
In our March event was canceled, but in early April, we'll be talking with John Tomasi and Matt Swolinski about their fantastic book, which is an intellectual history of the libertarian movement called The Individualists, Radicals, Reactionaries, and the Struggle for the Soul of Libertarianism. Go to reason.com/events for information about that and other events in New York and elsewhere.
Awesome. And if you like what we do at this institution, please consider a tax-deductible donations. Go to reason.com/donate for more information. Thank you to everyone for listening. Thank you, Emma Camp. Well done, young Camp. And we should be welcoming Peter Suderman back next week, although without segment titles. Goodbye.